Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Katie Orr. As the pandemic creeps into its second year and as the climate continuously reminds us it's changing, writer Anne Lamott notes that existential exhaustion is everywhere we look these days. In her new book, Dusk, Night, Dawn, Lamott asks, where on earth do we start to get our world and joy and hope and our faith in life itself back? Lamott's approach is both spiritual and funny, embracing darkness and light. And we want to hear from you. What has been bringing you hope and joy? That's next on Forum, right after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Katie Orr. In her new book, Dusk, Night, Dawn, Anne Lamott tells a story about her power going out. That becomes a reflection on light and darkness that feels very appropriate for our current times. Shadows steal the show so often when light isn't looking, she writes. Light thinks it's Beyoncé shimmering with celestial meanings. But Shadow knows that without it, we ain't got nothing to show for ourselves. No paintings, poetry, or song. Anne Lamott joins us for the hour, and we'll want to hear from you. What has this dark time brought you that you're grateful for? What are you finding hope, joy, and light in? Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Anne Lamott, welcome to Forum. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
So my first question to you is, how's married life?
Well, there's a whole chapter in the new book on, I think it's a prologue, in fact, on going around on book tours, having people say their first question, how's married life? And how I just want to poke him in the head like a baked potato. But, you know, I got married 3 days after I got Medicare. But I didn't know that of the first 2 years, one of them would be in quarantine. So most of the time, it's really fun and sweet. I like this guy a lot, and we're still speaking. But other times, in quarantine, I feel a little crunchy, and I'll listen to the sound of him eating bacon, and I'll start to just lose my mind.
That is so funny. I have friends who have told me very similar experiences. They have to eat in separate rooms because they just cannot stand. I mean, and you mentioned you got married later in life. You were newly married when you wrote this book. First of all, did you ever think that you would get married?
I didn't feel a frantic need to. I love being alone. I'm really an introvert. I love to have the house to myself. I love the sacrament of putter and ploppage, you know, where you don't have to be nice to anybody and you can just read all day, which is really all I ever wanted. And I didn't really expect to, no, but I met this guy on Match. You can actually Google, I think, Anne Lamott on Match and read the piece. And it was really an accident. And in fact, the day we'd been living together for a couple years, so it wasn't like I wasn't really aware of his gravest character defects and little peccadillos, nor was he of mine. But one day, a few years ago, we were watching the U.S. Open on TV, and he said, can I ask you something? You know, I was right in the middle of like a Serena Williams match. And I said, oh, sure. Because I thought we had to make a decision about the patio pebbles. And I said, oh, sure. And he said, will you marry me? And I looked at him as if he had just burst into flame. I said, wait, what? But then our cat had gone missing a couple. And so I said, can we have a cat? Can we get a new cat? And he said, yes. So we call that the cat codicil. And then we got married. It wasn't really that big a deal. It was like a huge party. Everybody over eight, you know, and we danced.
Sounds perfect. That's how weddings should be.
Yeah.
Well, are you thankful that it happened right before lockdown, the pandemic, or it doesn't seem like it really would have changed much for you?
Well, let me answer that in a roundabout way by saying that my last book was called something, Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. And I had wanted to call it Doomed, Notes on Hope, because we were 2 years into Trump. We had the UN climate change papers had just come out, and I was doing a book tour with Neil around the country, and everywhere I went, people just felt flattened and defeated. And it looked like Trump had a very good chance of being reelected, and that meant no help for the climate and no help for the poor. The only two things that really matter. Oh, and democracy, that little thing. But so I started to think about writing a book that would address the crisis that people's spirits were in, that they didn't believe that they would get second winds, and that, my mother was from Liverpool, so the battle cry was, it's all over for England. And I didn't think it was. I thought of the great Yeats poem where he said, the center will not hold. And I thought, but the center always has hold in its own kind of lifey way, you know, and it's a bit too lifey for me some days, but the center, because of our dearest friends, keeps holding. And so I wrote this book, and I had been with Neil, and that was making me pretty happy most of the time, which is a miracle, if you ask my tiny cranky self, because, David Roach, the great humorist with a very severe facial deformities, is the pastor. He founded a church called the Church of 80% Sincerity, of which I'm a member. And he says 80% of anything really is a miracle. You know, 80% of being honest and being generous and being positive. And so 80% of the time, I feel very, very blessed and lucky. I mean, no, I wasn't expecting this. And then I just kept, you know, taking the next right step. And I always say to my writing students, do it afraid, but do it, you know? So mm-hmm. I kept moving forward with Neil, and he kept meeting me halfway. And, a lot of Dusk Night Dawn is about forgiveness. And I do believe that Earth is forgiveness school. And why not practice at your own dining room table? So, I am glad, and it has been, I won't lie, been very, very strange to have my second year of marriage be in lockdown. So, COVID college was supporting us, which is to say that everybody had to learn how to have a new ordinary life since we couldn't go anywhere. And I always say, hooray for ordinary life. That's where we see the divine. That's where we see the goodwill of most people, the incredible sharing and generosity of most people. You know, like Mr. Rogers' mother always told him during crisis and tragedy, look to the helpers. And so we, in COVID college, looked to the EMT, all those nurses who died. Oh my God. And we looked at those long lines, 3 and 4 miles long, at the food pantries of parents just trying to get a box of food for their kids. And we saw the people, the volunteers, getting them that food. And so we learned, I think, how really deep the well of compassion inside of us was. And we got more reflective and contemplative because we couldn't go anywhere, you know? And we had to pay better attention to what was right in front of us since we weren't going to the movies or to ACT or to the museums. I mean, right now the daffodils are blooming 6 feet away from where I'm sitting in these with their crazy yellow and orange clown frills, you know, and their huge schnozzes. And so in this year, we've learned to notice and to pay attention, which if you're going to be a writer is the most important thing you can learn to do. So with Neil in a new marriage, I learned all those things. My life got much, much quieter. I wasn't racing around like the white rabbit thinking I had all of these important things to do today, like to remember to get graph paper, you know? And instead, we were doing the sacrament of ploppage. Neil's out in his garden. I'm writing my stuff. I'm taking the very old dog for walks. And it's there's been a lot of blessing.
I want to get to a caller right now. David in Berkeley, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. First, I want to also thank Anne for her amazing writing. I've been teaching an excerpt from Bird by Bird called Fecal First Draft. It's actually not fecal, but it's you know what I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
And that's a very helpful article. But this semester, I'm a writing teacher, a college writing teacher, and this semester has been more difficult than last semester, the most difficult semester I've taught. I've found that no matter what I do, my students' motivation is just leaking away. They're undergoing so many challenges. I teach both international students and immigrant students. And I, as they're struggling, I find that I'm really struggling. I'm feeling so, so insufficient, and I feel so helpless. I've done everything that I can think of, but teaching online, you don't have that connection with students. And I just am at a loss. I don't know how to hold them, how to bring them back. I'm just wondering if you have any advice.
Well, that's a great question. And I think that it probably applies to everything besides writing students. Like, how do we bring people back to, you know, to fighting the good fight? Like Molly Ivan said, you know, the freedom fighters don't always win, but they're always right. And writers don't usually get published, but they can find salvation in the act of writing, in the habit of telling their stories, whether or not they reach a bigger audience. And so, you know, I'll just tell you what I tell my writing students, and none of very, very few of them get published. And so they get very discouraged, and especially during COVID, when you couldn't even go to readings and you couldn't go to writing groups and whatnot. But I tell them that no one cares whether they're writing or not, so they better. You know, they need to, you can't get them to do the deep dive into themselves where it really matters that they tell their truth and tell their stories, you know, and that there is a need for their stories. That, like the great Barry Lopez said, sometimes we need stories more than we need food. And so the need for people and people that have just arrived in this country, or people who have started writing for the first time in 40 years, the need for them to share their experience, strength, and hope, and their memories, and their visions, and their everything has never been more important. So I think what you do is you just help them keep it really, really small. It's bird by bird.
And we have to go and take a quick break right now. We're talking with Bay Area writer Anne Lamont. If you would like to weigh in on the conversation, give us a call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or at KQED Forum on Twitter.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We're talking with Bay Area writer Anne Lamont. Her new book is Dusk, Night, Dawn. And you were sort of getting at this before the break, but I wonder how COVID or pandemic has affected your creativity. And you had written something, you describe writing as words tugging at your sleeve. And I just relate to that so much, because there are times when it feels like, you know, the words just have to come out. You just have to write. It's like it's not a choice. Unfortunately, more often I find myself sitting at my computer just being like, write, 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 instead of the words you know, tumbling out. But how has your creativity been affected this past year?
Well, that's a great question. I also wanted to just finish what I wanted to say about the last question of how do you get people back to that debt of honor that we have as writers to get our work done one day at a time. And I think what's scary and is like that all that blank paper, and especially in the COVID, the blank paper and the great silences all around us of no longer having gatherings and the great nutritious air of being with like-minded men and women. But Doctorow said something, E.L. Doctorow, that I love, that I think is the secret of life in all areas. He said, writing is like driving at night with the headlights on. You can only see a little ways in front of you, but you can make the whole journey that way. And so with you or with the last person's question and people that are feeling really, really flattened after a year of not getting to meet and be encouraged and given approval for what they, it's so hard to write. Writing is so hard, but they haven't been able to get the approval or the enthusiasm of their friends and their teachers and the other writing students. But if you keep it really small, you can get it done. I always had my students put a 1-inch picture frame on their desk, and all they had to do on any given day was whatever they could see through that 1-inch picture frame, one memory, one passage, one vision, one idea, one possible ending, or even more harrowing, one possible beginning. And that's all they had to do, because it's the huge unassaulted ice flow of an unwritten memoir or a novel or screenplay or poem that is so kind of stifling. And so you write one thing and you write it really badly. Secret of life.
Yes. Yes. I think that is such good advice, because it's so hard. Often I find if I can just make myself write the first sentence, then the rest comes. But it's looking at the totality of it that is just overwhelming. I want to go to Lindsay in San Mateo. Lindsay, go ahead.
Hey there. I just want to preface this statement by saying how much I really appreciate the conversation and certainly don't begrudge anyone the opportunity to be able to slow down. But as somebody that is an operations manager of a bakery, and I'm lucky to have a job, and this hasn't been quiet for many of us. This hasn't been silence and quietness. This has been nothing but noise. And I would just love to hear stories from that perspective. And I understand we can't write that perspective because we're busy working, but just constantly hearing about the struggle of creatives because of how slow and quiet it is, that's so hard. And I just think being able to hear a different story from a different perspective, not just the struggle, but what have we noticed in the noise, in this change, not just what have we noticed in the silence. And I think it's just really disappointing that there's not more of that. And I guess I'll just let that statement stand and, take my comment off the air.
Well, thank you so much, Lindsay. Yeah, go ahead, Anne. How do you respond to
that? It's a great question, and the whole book, Dusk Night Dawn, is those stories, you know, because mostly they were written before COVID, but they were written in the crisis of the UN papers on climate change, and they were written in the crises of what goes on at our own dining tables, and the crises of, you know, of a failing economy, an economy where the rich get fantastically richer and the middle class and the poor do worse and worse, and the whole system is unfair and jerks win. You know, that's just reality. And so the stories in this book are really about where you start. You start where your butt is. You start in what's true. You start in that day, and you push back your sleeves and you look around and you see what is still working in COVID college, even if you're in a really chaotic work environment. What still works there? Well, people are being really gentle with themselves. And people are, when I was coming up in the 50s, people used to talk about sacrifice, which I don't think you hear anymore, and sacrificial love, and people getting out of themselves to become people for others. So we have two, where I live here with my son, my grandson, my husband's daughter, and all in these very separate spaces, and most everybody's working like crazy, and except for me, But because I have a book out, and so I don't have to, I can't be expected to do much of anything until I'm stable again psychiatrically. But everybody's working like crazy. And what I'm seeing them doing, all of these other people, the other grown-ups here, they're taking on what other people can't handle. And they're saying, what can I do? Can I take any of that off of you? I can take your shift. If you need to be with your family, if your family's scared, and let me do it. I'm good. And then you can make it up to me down the road or not. And so all I can say is I wrote a whole book of stories that I think answer that question, that we see how much grace there is, whatever you think of as grace. I think of it as spiritual WD-40. And a friend of mine, a very aged priest in LA, said, the secret is not to try harder, but to resist less. And so with stuff, with kind of pandemonium all around you, it's maybe good to not try to horse it all into submission, but instead to resist less and to maybe help people get their sense of humor back by working on your own sense of humor. And I always think that laughter is carbonated holiness, and that, or Trevor Noah said a few weeks ago, he said, if you're laughing with people, you know you're really sharing something, you know? And so if you're freaked out and overwhelmed and you share it, you get your sense of humor back. It's pain divided. It's overwhelm divided. So it's a great question, but it takes a whole book to answer it.
I wonder... you know, of course, your subtle humor is a hallmark of your writing. And one thing I personally love about people, I find during like dark times, like we've been going through, that people are just really, they can be very funny, and they're not doing it for anyone else. It's just sort of like a way for them to cope, even in the most painful situations. I mean, what is your take on that? It seems like humor really is one of the ways we're so sort of designed to cope with adversity.
Humor, and but also for me, tears, you know, crying and laughter and service are the ways that I cope. Crying, I've talked about laughter, which is really hard some days. You know, my very first book, Hard Laughter, was about trying to keep our sense of humor in our family when I was 24 or 23 and my dad was diagnosed with metastatic brain cancer. It was called Hard Laughter, and it is still really hard some days. And as I said, life is just way too lifey about a third of the time. But so there's laughter, and then there's crying and letting yourself do real. You know, there's probably two or three your very, very best friends that you could cry with. And I was so, in the 50s, you just didn't cry. If you cried or were angry at the dinner table, you got sent to your room without eating. So coincidentally, some of us ended up with tiny lifelong eating disorders. And we were shamed we were told not to cry. It was unseemly. And I got sober 35 years ago, and the women who helped me get sober said, cry. You know, that they taught me that the crying would hydrate me and cleanse me and moisturize and baptize me. And it was going to water the seeds in the very, very dry ground at my feet. And it was just going to be such a relief. There's only a couple people I can cry with, but boy, is that the most... I cry so rarely, and when I cry, I feel like God has reached down and touched me, and I'm better afterwards. And the third thing is service. You know, if I want to have generous and loving feelings inside of me, paradoxically, I need to take loving and generous actions. You know, that you take the action and the insight follows. You know, figure it out is a terrible slogan for life. And so the easiest thing to do is to fill up a bag of canned foods and powdered foods. And of course, it being Easter and Passover, you should get a bunch of peeps for the kids in families who aren't doing well, and you take it over to the areas of your county where the service people live, where the incidence of COVID is so much higher, and you drop off a couple bags of food and peeps anonymously. You signal one of the volunteers, you say, here, just take this, and then you get really happy for the rest of the day. I don't know how that works, but 100% of the time, if you want to get really loving, warm feelings, do call your most annoying relative. The person who, and I'll be 67 in 2 weeks, who for 67 of 66 of the, oh, say, let's say 65 of those years, has had weird comments about your body, your life choices, your partners, your everything. And you call her because she's very lonely. She's in a home. And you call her and you say, hey, can I come over later today in the parking lot? I've got both my vaccines and I have a present for you. And if they say no, you say, okay, well, I just want to check in, make sure you're okay. So there are these simple actions you can take that are going to completely cause the plates of the earth to shift underneath you. And you're going to get in a friendlier mood. It just happens to be true.
I want to go to Sammy in Corta Madeira. Sammy, go ahead.
Hi, this is Sammy. And I want to tell you, I have been laughing when you were describing how you would eat breakfast across from your husband when you first got married, and you'd hear his slopping over his soup, and everything was so loud. And I thought, oh my God, am I going to do any 5 years of this? And it's just, you are so special. You know, the funny thing is, we met in a writing class, and everything we wrote about, we were opposites. And I don't know how we knew each other. This is way back in the 50s. We knew each other for, 6 years or something before we were married. And, you know, everything was so different in that world. So we never lived together. We never had any connection with each other. And then when we got married, it was, oh, my God, really? And now we've been married 60 years.
Wow. And
do you know the funny thing is? We're like two peas in a pod. I mean, it's just, we're just exactly, we think together the same way. We don't have to say too much because we're thinking the same thing. And it's really, I mean, it's been a joy now. When I look back, we've just had such a wonderful life together. But in the beginning, it was not easy. Absolutely. Yeah. And I give you great credit that you did this. You got married for the first time, what was it, just 3 years?
2 years
two
ago,
years
yeah.
after you got your Medicare, right?
Yeah. 3 days after I got Medicare. Yeah.
Sammy, thank
anyway,
you so
thank
much
you, and mazel tov. You know, and lots of things are hard. Marriage is hard. Intimate relationships are hard. The turning climate change around is going to be hard. Having kids who scare you to death is hard. But you know what? What this book is about is that we're good at hard. We stopped smallpox. We came up with the antiretrovirals. Some of us have watched our kids get clean and sober. Some of us have survived unsurvivable loss. So hard shouldn't stop us. We've stopped fascism a couple times now. But anyway, that's wonderful, and mazel tov on your wonderful marriage of all these years.
And I wonder how you approach joy and the guilt you might feel, some people might feel, for feeling that. I just mean that, you know, we all live in this world. There are horrible things happening 24/7. I work in the news business, so I feel like sometimes I'm acutely aware of them. But then, you know, I also have two little kids, and it's really important to be happy and present for them. But you almost feel guilty, almost like, how can I be happy when there's all this stuff happening in the world? I wonder, how do you think people should reclaim joy, but also be okay with feeling that way?
Well, I mean, I think it's just such a balance. The world is heartbreaking, and families can be heartbreaking, and what happens to our elders and what happens to the poor. And, you know, if And we all have, you know, all good people have a lot wrong with them. You know, if you feel scared or guilty or angry or lost and very odd, then come on over and sit with us. Otherwise, we're not interested. And so we also have the scar tissue inside of us, you know, that is, and we do have the shame and the guilt. And if I could just take that one aspect of what I hear you saying is the guilt about that we're doing much, much better than 95% of the world. But my Jesuit friend, Tom Weston, said the most brilliant thing to me that changed my life 25 years ago. He said, the five rules of being an American adult are that, one, you must not have anything wrong with you or different about you. And rule, you must be able to pass in all circumstances. Rule two is, if you have something wrong with you or different, and I would add, or better about you, but if you have something wrong or different about you, you really have to get over it as quickly as you can. And rule three is that if you can't get over it or correct it or seem to be just like everybody else, you should pretend that you have, that you are, you know, that it's not an issue anymore. The fourth rule is that if you can't even pretend to have gotten over it, or that you should just not show up because it's really so painful for the rest of us to see you. And the fifth rule is that if you're going to insist on the right to show up, you should at least have the decency to feel ashamed. And so that is what everyone I know and every single, I probably taught 10,000 writing students, every single one of them has been up against. It's this shame, this institutionalized and internalized shame that either we're not good enough or we're doing better than everybody. And so that is where I urge people to begin, is to do the deep dive into, you know, if you want to heal it, you got to reveal it. And what you got to do is tell your very, very best girlfriend that you have it. And she will almost certainly will say, oh, I do too. Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned it. Then you start talking about it and you talk about how painful it is to have that, and that you do feel guilty, and that you have more than anyone. So what should you do? Give away as much as you can bear. You know, send it off to food pantries, send it off to your local NPR station, KQED, send it off to the ACLU, send it off to the lawyers who are working with the children at the border. Give away everything you can, and you will start to be healed of the shame that you're doing okay. You know, and it's hard and it's scary and it's weird, and we're good at hard.
Yeah. We're talking with Bay Area writer Anne Lamott. Her new book is Dusk, Night, Dawn, and we want to hear from you. How have you been finding hope and joy, and where have you been finding it? Or let us know why you're losing hope. Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Katie Orr, and we're talking with Bay Area writer Anne Lamott. Her new book is Dusk, Night, Dawn. I wanted to read a comment from Kate. She writes, I am a writer and also a single mom of two young kids who've been out of school for a year, so my pandemic has been anything but quiet and calm. It has been transformative, and at some point I'll be able to write about it. But whew, not now, she says. Susan writes, it's so hard for me to start writing and life is so busy. Any other suggestions for being more disciplined about writing, even if just for ourselves? And I know you've talked about this a little bit, but you know, it seems like people are craving advice on how they can just sit down and write. I mean, what do they do? Do they just sit down and write?
Yeah, you know, nobody can get you to do it. You got to get your butt in the chair It's the single most complex part of the whole problem. Is I always think of Winnie the Pooh, of Christopher Robin's pop gun, and you have to hold the pop gun to your head, and you have to sit down. I use bribes and threats all through. My life is not quiet, by the way. It's a lot more quiet and contemplative, but I have a grandchild here who goes to school and mostly didn't get to, and mostly was on video Zoom school, and there's a lot of chaos here, and I have always very, very sick friends with whom I'm putting in a lot of energy and attention and walks in masks 6 feet away. So it's not like I'm sitting here in a Buddhist trance. But with the writing thing, and I know it's hard, I don't have a little kid, and I don't know how people do it, to be frank, but except for grace and the spiritual WD-40 and that we're good at hard. But with the writing, you know, you gotta get yourself to the chair. Bribes and threats, which were mostly what I relied on as a single mother with no money, I would bribe and threat my child into doing, behaving, and into doing what he needed to do, his homework and his Lego time and his growing up and his shower and whatnot. But as a writer, what works for me is to say, okay, Annie, if you write, look at that 1-inch picture frame, you're only going to write, it's going to take an hour, that one passage where you're out at that pond in Inverness, you're 6 years old, you're with your Uncle Don, he's drunk, and that thing happens that maybe changed you forever. It's all you're going to write. And I want you to do it really badly. I want you just to get it all down on paper. And if you do that, then we're gonna get up and go watch MSNBC for half an hour. And then you sit back down and you do the bribe. What's the bribe? Okay, if you can write that one passage about going for a walk with somebody who you really, really can't stand, who really makes your skin run crawling for its cute little life, then I'm going to make you a grilled cheese sandwich. And you just keep doing it. It's little by little. It's that doctoral line. It's writing. It's like driving at night with the headlights on. You can only see a little ways in front of you, and you can make the whole journey that way. So you do 10 feet of driving in the dark, and you do it badly. You know, one last thing that I always think is helpful is, if there is any way, probably online, to find a writing partner or a small writing group that you could do it easily by Zoom, or you could do it at your local independent bookstore once we're all back, and you have a commitment to them that you are going to show up with 5 finished pages every 2 weeks. And, and also if you buy a book at an independent bookstore, it guarantees you a better seat in heaven, closer to the dessert table or the cheese table, where I will be. And if you have somebody who's breathing their hot breath down your neck because you owe them some pages, that's a really great incentive.
I want to go to Bola in San Jose. Go ahead.
Hi, this is my first time calling to forum, because I really love NPR station. I wanted to say that one of the positive things for me is just watching some of my favorite old shows that I've used to watch when I was a kid, even some of my favorite cartoons. Also, another thing is watching YouTube and just finding ways, just using that to find ways to be creative, and also exercising, because just these past 5 months I've been on and off working out, whether it be outside or just mainly indoors, but it's been really helping me as well, because it's gotten my endorphins up. I'm a lot calmer, I'm more relaxed. But and also, just as kind of an artist myself, I really want to find ways. It really taught me, this pandemic has really taught me to really pursue my passions with no apologies, because, I mean, with being indoors, it's like we have to be creative. And for me, it's like I've been finding ways to be creative, and it's really helped me stay positive and have hope.
I love that. Following your passions with no apologies. That's awesome.
That's awesome. And yeah, if you can get out and walk every day somehow, or if you can get someone to wheel you out every single day, it's a miracle. You know, it's like a, you look up, you look around, you do anything what the writer is supposed to be doing anyway, you notice that there really are green shoots breaking through the concrete and the grout in the garden tiles. It's like being spritzed back awake, you know, and it's our old pastor used to have a great sermon about how you can trap bees in mason jars with a drop of honey on the bottom of it without a lid because they don't look up. You know, they just kind of walk around bitterly bumping into the glass walls, and all they have to do is look up, and they can fly away. And all we have to do is step outside and look up to be better than we were, you know, because you look up and you say, wow, what a beautiful sky. You don't look up and go, well, that's kind of a medium full moon tonight. You know, you look up and you say, wow. And you might even get a tiny flicker of gratitude for the beauty of nature.
I wonder how you have dealt with giving up control this year, because it seems like no matter what our circumstances, everyone's had to give up some kind of control. And, you know, especially for people who like to have things a certain way, this year has not been good for that. I mean, how have you been coping?
Well, I think that's been really hard for everyone because we live in our comfort zone tends to do with feeling, with having this illusion that we're in control. But I have a disease of good ideas for other people. And it's one of the ways as a child, I had a measure of control in thinking that I was the problem. I was the reason my parents were so unhappy together, and I could just do better and shine brighter, but not shine so bright that it made my older brother feel bad in comparison. So that was a lot of stress, and I had migraines at 5 years old. So if I felt that I was the problem, there's control there. And if I felt that I was the solution, there's the control there. That if I was responsible, you know, I had a little clipboard at 5 and 6 with a caseload, mom, dad, my older brother, and the baby who I was raising, because my parents were so unhappy and they probably should have chosen to raise orchids or teacup poodles instead of children. So those two things have been default places I land on. And it's kind of, they're my comfort zones, thinking I'm the problem and need to do better, and that that I have good ideas for everybody to be happy again and happy all the time. And you know what? And so you can kind of bust yourself of that I don't even have good ideas for me, you know? And how could I, if it's not my problem, I probably don't have a very good idea for someone else. And this has been a huge blessing of COVID college to realize what an illusion most of our effort. I do have tiny, tiny, tiny problems with control. And for me to get busted gently by life and by my own willingness to start to give that up, you know, to do what my friend Terry I mentioned said is not to, the secret being not to try harder, but to resist less. And to start to see that people are actually kind of doing okay. They're on their own hero's journey. And it's disrespectful. Like with my son is 31. And for me to get on his path with him, on his journey with, you know, I would bring along sunscreen and chapstick and a juice box. It's disrespectful. And it actually hurts him. But I have this longing to control. I don't want more bad things to happen to him. He has had 9 years clean and sober, and I want to control this a little bit so that he doesn't, you know, slip. Yeah. And it's disrespectful, not only disrespectful, but it doesn't work. I don't always let that stop me. but so, you know, the awareness is where I begin when I notice that I'm trying to control me or life. You know, I'm trying to horse life into submission. It never works, and it makes everybody worse than they already were, including me.
It reminds me of, like, fighting with my toddler.
Oh my God. Right. But I have to interrupt. I have to interrupt just for 1 second to correct something from the last segment. That my husband does not eat in a slurpy way, nor does he almost ever eat soup. And plus, this is God's own truth, that eating with him every night on the couch is like church for me. It's like heaven. We both eat whatever we want. We often don't eat the same thing. And we watch Rachel Maddow, and it's heaven. So I wanted just to clear that up.
That's so nice.
Since he may be listening. Yeah.
Right. I want to go to BZ in Sonora. Go ahead.
Hey, this is a real honor for me because, Annie, you have been one of my heroes for the last 25, 30 years. And you have said things today that just sink down into my soul. And I sometimes feel like you're walking inside of my brain when you are writing, and today when you're talking. And with regards to me and how COVID has impacted my own life, I happen to be a storyteller, and I travel a great deal, and I work in my community a great deal doing storytelling programs. But since COVID, of course, all of that stopped, like everything in the performance industries stopped. And as a result of that, for the first time in my adult life, I'm 71, I've been forced to, like, stay home. And mm-hmm. and in that joyful imprisonment, I remembered everything that I've been wanting to do at home for decade after decade, projects. I finished a quilt. We finally did a vegetable garden for the first time, finally. One of my grandkids is living with us, and he has been my wonderful Sherpa for everything that has to happen on our two-acre piece of property. I am actually going for walks every day on those 2 acres. I don't have to go anywhere. I can just walk out here in my own yard. And mm-hmm. it's been such a gift of time that is for my own soul, for my own replenishment. And and you know, I read Bird by Bird, and I used to be an English teacher, and I used that phrase constantly with my students to just remind them, you just do it bird by bird. And I just want to thank you for the rich blessing that you've given to so many, myself deeply. And the other thing, I just want to end with this. I decided that in this time of COVID, it was a perfect opportunity to embrace new learning that I had just been putting aside. I happen to be a member of Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma. I've been wanting to learn our native language forever. And so what have I been doing during COVID? I've been learning to speak Wyandotte with a wonderful culture keeper within our tribe. And
thank you so much, BZ. I really appreciate it.
I love it.
I wonder, we've been hearing a lot about people, you know, who have found ways to cope with this pandemic. I feel like, how do we turn our hope for better times for this world into actual change? And does finding a more spiritual, peaceful place make people, do you think, more or less likely to go out and actually change the world?
Well, I think everybody has been in a better mood since November 4th. And that it has, I mean, the subtitle of Dusk Night Dawn is on renewal and courage. And I think people feel a lot less frightened. And that gives them renewal and a second wind. But yeah, I think spiritually, to keep it very simple, to just think about Earth as forgiveness school tells me everything I need to know on any given day, that, that, you know, nonviolent resistance changes the people who are hurting us. You know, the oath keepers, or whoever they were on January 6th, the promise keepers, the far right, you know, who are just constantly searching the scripture for people to hate so that they can relax a little. But you just keep nonviolent resistance and forgiveness. Like Martin Luther King said, don't let them get you to hate them. Right. Mm. And that's so profound. You look at the forgiveness in the culture, and you become a part of that. Look at the Amish when there was that slaughter in their school and all those schoolgirls were killed by one of their own. The Amish responded by welcoming the wife of the shooter into their community and into their memorial services. They said, come be in this with us. Or look at Mother Emmanuel. You know, when 10 or 11 people were slaughtered during Bible study, what did they talk about? They talked about forgiveness. They preached forgiveness. And so the slaughter became about love and radical forgiveness and sweet faces. And we can become a part of that by deciding that we now are, and we're not positive what the action is. But again, something will tug on your sleeve like it does when you're writing, and it will help you know what the next right action is.
Amy writes on how she's finding joy. About once a month, a group of friends get together on Zoom, and we all bring some work of art to share. It can be a painting, sculpture, story, poem, song that we made ourselves or not. And then this leads to great appreciation for each other and to discussions about our lives and etc. Michael tweets, gardening brings him joy, even though seeds were in short supply last year and his favorite nursery was deemed non-essential. Just sitting in the backyard pulling weeds, driving to the country, to the county park to walk the dog. I think those are just such great ways. It's so interesting. You talk a lot about friendship. I noticed during this pandemic year, I have had a bunch of girlfriends from college, and we were all very close, but we've grown up, have families, all that stuff. But we've come back together just once or twice over Zoom, but it makes such a difference. I mean, how important have your friends been during this year?
Just huge. But I do walk every day, and I have some walks with girlfriends, one from when I was 6 years old, my best friend from 6 years old, and I still walk a few times a week. I walk with my husband, Neil, and I walk with two very, very, very sick people, which is the slowest kind of Thich Nhat Hanh walking you can do. But my friends have been everything. But, you know, so has my church community on Zoom, and so have, which is very small, 30 people, and so have my recovery communities. And it's like little living Advent calendars, you know, of our 1 and 2 inch faces, sharing with us at a really intimate and loving level. So it's really my friends, my 2 or 3 or 4 best friends, my younger brother, my husband, my son, and my grandson are entirely the reason that I have been able to keep the faith for the last year, let alone the last 4 years.
We've been talking with writer Anne Lamott, and you've been listening to Forum. I'm Katie Orr. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead. Forum is produced by Tina Lauenberg, Polly Stryker, Grace Wan, and Caroline Smith. Our interim senior editor is Judy Campbell. Our engineers are Danny Bringer, Katie McMurrin, and Brendan Willard. Our interns are Leslie Torres and Kimeya Akbari. Our executive editor is Ethan Tovin Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. I'm Katie Orr. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Did you ever wonder what it's like to live alone, hidden in the woods, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years? Or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest water hole for 2,000 miles? The Snap Judgment Podcast takes you there with amazing stories told by the people who live them, with an original soundscape that drops you directly into their shoes. Snap Judgment. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.